ways that we choose to tell matter. They shape us. They shape our values, our society, and the six sources of our Unitarian Universalist living tradition invites us to tell stories from a wide diversity of places. We need to tell stories about our direct experience, what we know to be true because we've experienced in the crucible of our own first-hand knowledge. We need to tell stories about the breadth of the world's religions. We need to tell stories about the importance of human reason and what we've learned through the world-changing discoveries of modern science. And in addition, the second source of Unitarian Universalism calls on us to tell the challenging stories of the words and deeds of prophetic men and women, which challenge us to confront powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love. And in that spirit, I want to share with you the story of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, born in 1907. He died in 1972. Heschel was one of the great prophetic figures of the 20th century. To many observers, it was as if one of the biblical prophets had been reborn in our own day. And instead of having that safe distance of reading a sacred text about the injustices being condemned centuries ago, Heschel was a living human being calling out injustices in our society that we were perpetuating and calling on us to change. But let me start at the beginning. How many of you feel like you already know a fair amount about Rabbi Heschel? Anybody? Anybody remember seeing him, reading about him in the newspaper, seeing him on TV, a few? Okay. Anybody ever see him speak in person? Okay, well, the sermon is clearly in order. Very good. One of the most formative influences on Heschel's life was being an eighth generation Hasidic rabbi. No pressure, right? Moreover, his ancestors had not just been any line of rabbis. His family had been highly influential since the beginning of the Hasidim. You may be familiar with the name, the Baal Shem Tov, who in the 18th century founded the Hasidic movement, a mystical branch of Judaism. And when he died, one of Abraham Joshua Heschel's ancestors, Rabbi Heschel of Opt, became the spokesperson for their Hasidic generation. And had circumstances been different, our Rabbi Heschel from the 20th century would likely have continued in his ancestors' footsteps and been either a rabbi or a professor, and he probably would have stayed in Eastern Europe, if not Poland. But instead, as a Jew coming of age in Poland, coming to adulthood in Poland, Rabbi Heschel's life changed dramatically with Hitler's rise to power, as you can imagine. One of the first major challenges Heschel had to confront was that although he was a brilliant student, the academic system he was in required that doctoral students not just complete and have an approved dissertation, but you had to publish that dissertation as a book before you would actually get your PhD. And he was seeking to publish his first book, which was explicitly about the Hebrew prophets, in a climate that was growing increasingly hostile to all things Jewish. And the letter he received in December 1935 from his dean at the University of Berlin, granting him an extension on finding a publisher, was signed with an ominous Heil Hitler above the signature. The growing anti-Semitism led Heschel to immigrate to the United States in 1940, where he was hired to teach first at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati and then at Jewish Theological Seminary in New York. And in retrospect, knowing the world historical beloved figure that he was to become, it's fascinating to note that students, especially at first, really didn't respond to him well in the classroom. The primary reason was likely cultural. In European universities, students would rise when the professors entered the and expressed themselves openly and freely. Now, furthermore, Heschel tended to teach not in a standard lecture format, not in a standard sort of linear mode of discourse, but with digressions, which the American students often couldn't follow because Heschel had just grown up. He was so deeply immersed in these classic Jewish texts that his digressions, they just couldn't follow it because it was given in an organic matter instead of a linear fashion. Heschel also had the habit of some European professors of not preparing an original lecture for his courses. Instead, no matter what the course was, he would just read whatever piece of his writing he was currently working on. And you wonder how people publish so much, right? So you're just constantly reading in class what you're working on. And he would even pause during the lecture to write corrections that occurred to him as he was reading his stuff out loud. At the same time, it should be noted that throughout his career, when students really resonated with him and came for help, he would spend hours with them, inviting them to his office for probing conversations, advising them on personal problems, nurturing their spiritual growth. And as bad as his early lectures apparently were, his prophetic voice would even then sometimes emerge distinctly in a way that left a lasting impression on those present. For example, in the wake of an involved discussion about whether gelatin is kosher, this is sort of the things that happen in Jewish seminaries, Heschel interjected with the question, excuse me, boys, can you tell me if the atomic bomb is kosher? Let's talk about something that matters. And as you can see, early on, Heschel had a particular talent for seeing these contemporary relevant analogies to sacred scripture. And as he became more aware of this part of himself, it's fascinating to see how he continued to cultivate that perspective, especially in his outward appearance. For instance, if you look at an author's photo on the dust jacket of his first major book, titled Man Is Not Alone, published in 1951, Heschel looks like he could be on the cast of Mad Men. He's 44, he's fresh-faced, clean-shaven, and short lady, dark hair, dark suit, wide-rimmed glasses. But by the late 50s, he'd grown a goatee, and his hair was becoming gray. By the 60s, as he's becoming increasingly well-known, especially in interfaith activism circles for social justice, he was really coming into his own and his external appearance, fully owning his role as sagacious rabbi meets Hebrew prophet. And just as Kennedy's youthful appearance buoyed his public perception, Heschel's long, flowing white beard and Einstein-like wild mane of hair, similarly made for just incredible photo ops, the press just ate it up, so it would really garner publicity for social justice causes that Heschel was seeking to draw attention to through his appearance alone sometimes. Most famously, a United Press International photographer took an iconic photo, you may have seen this, of Rabbi Heschel marching arm in arm with Dr. King on that Selma to Montgomery march in 1965. That's the same march in which the 38-year-old Unitarian minister James Reed was beaten to death and became a martyr of the civil rights movement. He was a member of All Souls in D.C., All Souls Unitarian. Heschel famously said about that day that the march was about protest and prayer. Legs are not lips, and walking is not kneeling, and yet our legs uttered songs, even without words, our march was worship. I felt like my legs were praying on that march from Selma to Montgomery. Heschel King and so many more put their life on the line, and in particular, that image of them walking together, King and Heschel became an icon of the civil rights movement and a testimony of black Jewish coalitions in the 1950s and the 1960s. And when King's life was taken 3 years later, Coretta Scott King invited Rabbi Heschel to be the one to read the Old Testament reading at King's funeral. It was this passage. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hid their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. From the prophet Isaiah. I should also add that Rabbi Heschel and Dr. King's friendship and activism together did not end with the civil rights movement.
raised deeply immersed in Hasidic Judaism, was more than ready to meet that objection. He promptly replied in writing with a 6-point defense of his choice. Don't challenge an 8th century Hasidic rabbi to a Torah interpretation battle. But more important than any of these reasons was Heschel's actual motivation, which was a keen sense that he sometimes had for public relations, like with the sense that I really need to grow my beard long and let my hair be bushy to cultivate that as a prophetic appearance. And so when he heard that Christians were going to be bringing a processional cross to that interfaith protest at Arlington National Cemetery, he knew it would look much worse that for Jews to be photographed behind a processional cross than for Jews to be caught with a Torah in the cemetery. So he boldly made the decision to ask his friend to bring and carry the Torah. He realized that theatrics and optics matter and can make all the difference in turning public opinion for or against a social justice movement. Speaking of perfect activism, Rabbi Heschel was also incredibly involved and proactive in Jewish-Catholic dialogue, particularly around the Second Vatican Council in the early 60s, which was, as you will probably remember, a tremendous liberalizing force in the Roman Catholic Church, against which we had a backlash, and now it's kind of midway again. But Rabbi Heschel was quite successful in developing a collegial working relationship with one of the main cardinals who was involved in writing the Vatican II documents, specifically the one that involved the Jewish religion. And although he did not find a sympathetic ear with Pope Paul VI, you remember that the more progressive Pope John XXIII, who had convened the council, had died a year earlier. He died before Vatican II ended. And in the midst of Heschel's advocacy within the Catholic hierarchy, his prophetic zeal sometimes showed itself stridently. One of the most prominent examples is that he said publicly, "As I have repeatedly stated to leading personalities of the Vatican, I am ready to go to Auschwitz at any time if faced with the alternative of conversion or death." So he was trying to really put public pressure on the Catholic Church to say that their goal is not to convert the Jews. And so I think his point was that after the Holocaust, the importance of Christians changing their understandings of Jews and their relation to contemporary Jews had to change. And due to Rabbi Heschel's involvement, the final Vatican II documents were likely much more open and inclusive toward Judaism than they would have been otherwise. And as I think about this mid-20th century example of a Jewish prophet calling the Christian church to reform, I can't help but think about the recent 84-page apostolic exhortation written by Pope Francis, or as some are calling him, Pope Frank. He's kind of a man of the people. To read just one short description from the New York Times, Pope Francis attacked unfettered capitalism as, quote, a new tyranny. And beseeched global leaders to fight poverty and growing inequality, Francis went further attacking, quote, the idolatry of money. It's as I said in last week's sermon, the problem isn't profit. The problem is profit alone, and when it isn't balanced with people, planet, and profit. And he called us to, quote, attack the structural causes of inequality and to strive to provide work, health care, and education to all citizens. And when I posted on social media about this document, one of my friends joked, "So if Obama is a communist for proposing stuff that's far less reaching, what does that make Pope Francis?" And when I saw his comment, the only reply I could think of was that, well, at least in the case of Pope Francis, it doesn't make him a communist, it makes him a Christian. We're just not used to seeing enough Christians like that. Thankfully, Pope Francis is somewhat of an example, even if not for women and his lesbians, but that's a separate sermon. Along these lines, someone said a similar thought about Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, that through him we have a glimpse of what it would look like if one of the Hebrew prophets, or if Rabbi Jesus, so to speak, lived in the U.S. in the 20th century. After all, Jesus was both Jewish and a rabbi, and Jesus is explicitly called a rabbi in the New Testament. And he was not a Christian, historically speaking. sort of self-centered in an interview, the spirit of the prophet, the message of the prophet, is very much alive. It didn't die in the 8th century BCE. The kind of men and women who combine very deep love, very powerful dissent, painful rebuke, they combine all that with unwavering hope. Hope that things can change. And in speaking about how the prophetic sensibility leads one to be deeply moving and involved with the feeling and crying out against the pain of the world, Rabbi Heschel famously said that the opposite of good is not evil. The opposite of good is apathy, not caring. As terrible as evil acts can be, Heschel challenges us to see that apathy can be even worse. That apathy is what allows evil to prosper and spread. And it would have been enough, as the Jewish tradition says, dying there. It would have been enough if Rabbi Heschel's heart had just been broken by the Holocaust in a way that would have led him to fight against future anti-Semitism, as he did in the Vatican II Council. But more remarkably, he became a prophetic figure on the world stage, which really resonates with our universalist tradition, because his heart was broken open by the Holocaust for all people, justice for everyone. And to give one among many examples, a journalist once asked him why he had come to a particular demonstration against the Vietnam War. And he said, "I'm here because I cannot pray." Confused and a bit annoyed, the journalist asked him, "What do you mean you can't pray? You come to a demonstration against the war because you can't pray?" And he replied, "Whenever I open the prayer book, I see before me children burning from napalm." And indeed, Heschel continued, "We forfeit the right to pray if we are silent about the cruelties committed in our name by our government. In a free society, some are guilty, but all are responsible. How dare we come before God with our prayers when we commit atrocities against the one image that we have of the divine, human beings?" These words deeply resonate with our UU first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. I should also add that that last story is told about Rabbi Heschel by his only child, a daughter, named Susanna Heschel, who is a professor of Jewish studies at Dartmouth College. And in that crucial test of whether renowned public figures are also admired by their families, not always the case, Rabbi Heschel also succeeded. Daughter Susanna Heschel writes about her father that although raised in a very traditional, gender-differentiated, pietistic home, my father recognized aspects of Judaism had to change, particularly for women. He asked me to lead prayers for the table. He even suggested that I become a conservative rabbi at a time when women's ordination seemed highly remote. I was the first daughter of my parents' circle to have a bat mitzvah, celebration at a synagogue on a Shabbat morning, and my request and my parents were fully supportive. My father used to say that while he was expected to become a Hasidic rabbi, he felt the world needed something different from him, and that Jewish women needed more as well. There's, of course, much more to say about Abraham Joshua Heschel's life, such as his remarkable friendship with Reinhold Niebuhr in the final years of Niebuhr's life. You may remember Niebuhr was one of those theologians back in the 60s who appeared on the cover of Time magazine, a very well-known figure. And his testimony to the friendship between Rabbi Heschel and this leading influential Christian theologian of the 20th century. When Niebuhr died in 1971 at age 78, the Jewish Rabbi Heschel was invited to give the only eulogy at his funeral. They were that close at the end of their life. Rabbi Heschel himself died the next year in 1972 at the far too young an age of 65. And surrounding his death, there's a classic story that two books lay on Heschel's night table. David Halberstam's expose of the Nixon War Cabinet, The Best and the Brightest, and Kedar Shemtov, a Hasidic classic. However, Sylvia Heschel, his wife, admitted later to a friend that she had deliberately positioned the books there after Heschel died before everyone arrived. What's actually there was a copy of Newsweek. read about the life of this 20th century Hebrew prophet, I encourage you to learn more about the life of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel and to allow his life to inspire your work today for social justice. But for now, I'll leave you with Heschel's own words in response to an interviewer who asked him what message he would say to young people if he had only 1 minute. Heschel replied, "I would say, let them remember that there is meaning beyond absurdity. Let them be sure that every little deed counts, that every word has power, and that we must do our share to redeem the world. In spite of all the absurdities and all the frustrations and all the disappointments, and above all, to remember that the meaning of life is to live your life as if it were a work of art." And as we continue